This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Doucet Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. President Obama's recent glowing economic report to Congress contained a glaring problem, acknowledged by both political parties: wage stagnation. The report confirms what many economists have long found: weak growth in American workers' pay, set in decades ago, and has only recently made some modest gains. Whether those gains will take hold, however, is in question, and both Democrats and Republicans say this will be a central issue in the 2016 presidential and congressional elections. Today in The Exchange, wage stagnation. What may be causing it, and what might be the way out? Let's hear from you. What's your own wage situation? Do you see this stagnation or not in your own life? And if you're an employer, what constraints do you feel around raising pay? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter, too, if you'd like. With me in studios, Dave Juvet, Senior Vice President at the Business and Industry Association of New Hampshire. Dave, good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.
Joining us by phone from D.C., Elise Gould, senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute. And Elise, good to have you too. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us from Dartmouth is Matt Slaughter, professor of management and incoming dean of the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College. And Matt, welcome back. Good to have you too.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Well, Matt, I want to start with you. This issue has been called by many people the defining challenge of our time. How do you see it?
It really is, Laura. Think about the American dream. I think for a lot of people that denotes a lot of different things, but for generations in America, it really represented the idea that with hard work and some good effort, individuals can improve their economic well-being over time, and so could their children when they think across time. And that happened not every year and by the same amount, but part of what has happened in recent decades is in the United States is for the large majority of workers, their earnings in real terms, that is adjusted for price inflation, haven't increased very much at all. So just to fix numbers here, last year, the most recent year of data that we have, the median household income in America, so line up all the households from the most modest means to Bill Gates or someone like that, median household income was just about $52,000. That's about $500 less than it was way back in 1989. So the big challenge is, though we've had some economic growth, why that isn't translating into rising earnings for most workers in America.
Well, and that's the big question that we'll dig into today, the why. But just give us a little more of the what, if you could, Matt. From what I understand, even though a lot of people are talking about this right now, this has been going on for a long time.
It has been going on for a long time. So it kind of depends on which class of workers that you look at. If you look at male workers with modest educational attainment in America, it's pretty sobering when you look at the data that inflation-adjusted earnings for adult males of, say, high school graduation, about that level of educational attainment, really haven't grown in about 40 years. So it depends on kind of which slice of the labor force you look at. What's been a little more sobering in recent years, since about 2000, is even people with a four-year college degree or those with a non-professional master's degree, so master's in social work or master's in education. Adjusting for inflation, those workers' earnings have been falling, not rising as well. And so part of what has become more concerning on both sides of the aisle in Washington and in, you know, around America and kitchen tables of families is for how many workers it seems to be that though they're trying hard at their job and have good intentions, their paychecks just don't seem to be keeping up with inflation or seem to be growing like they used to in earlier times.
Yeah, even though inflation is pretty low. Elise Gould, what's your perspective on this?
So I think one of the parts of the story is that what we know, in addition to everything Matt said, which is absolutely true, incomes have been stagnating. And for the vast majority of Americans, incomes mean how much people are making at work, right? That's what the most of incomes are made up of, is their wages and salaries. And if we look at what has happened, as he said, over the last 30, 40 years, we've seen very sluggish wage growth, if not stagnant wage growth. And that's at a time when we actually saw economic growth. So that's the other side of the coin here. We saw real GDP growth of almost 150% since 1979 and net productivity growth of 64-65% over this period. And so there's the potential has existed for ample broad-based wage growth over the last 35 years, but those economic gains have really not been realized, and they have bypassed the vast majority of people.
So give us that again, Elise, because it's pretty striking what you say. So since the 70s, basically, GDP has gone up 150%, productivity has gone up by 60-65%, and yet people's wages really haven't budged.
That's right. That's right. So over that period, when productivity and GDP growth were substantial, and again, that produces the potential for wages to rise, we see hourly compensation, so that's wages plus benefits, rising in that period by only 8%. So it's not zero, but it's certainly not anywhere near what the economy grew at.
Wow. How do you see this issue, Dave Juve? How do New Hampshire employers see this?
Well, I think, first of all, as Matt pointed out, this is going to be felt by a lot of people, but not felt by everyone universally. And I think in general, there's a population of workers that may not be feeling this to the same degree as others. And those are what I would call young professionals or people that are in the career development stage, people in their late 20s, 30s, and into their 40s, where they are making transitions from one level of job within their career to the next, and they get salary bumps associated with that. But I think that's probably a very, you know, a relatively narrow group of people. And there are other groups that are going to be feeling it stronger. I think lower income workers that don't have either the skills or education or opportunity to see advancement within the job, and also older workers, people of my generation who are transitioning towards the end of their careers and may not be making major jumps in that career ladder either. And so I talked with you earlier about, you know, people such as myself that have worked for an employer for a significant number of time, and we feel fortunate that we get an increase at all to match inflation, but over the course of, you know, 15 years, our actual earning power hasn't increased. And so it does affect different people differently. I will say one of the things that's happened over the last, I think, 30 or 40 years is it does get down to productivity. And earlier in the 20th century, in the 1900s, you know, productivity was increased by workers working faster, smarter, better, harder, and I think we'd see the benefits of that increased productivity. But that's changed a lot nowadays. Now productivity is maybe due to advances in computer manufacturing or advanced manufacturing or other high technologies and employers in those lines of businesses. And believe me, that's a vast array of employers are investing in that type of technological productivity increases.
I definitely want to ask about the productivity issue. I'm glad you brought that up, Dave, because that's a big issue. Let me also invite our listeners to join us. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. 1-800-892-6477. Today in the exchange, we're talking about wage stagnation. There's been a lot of conversation about this recently, but as our guests tell us, it's been going on for a long time. American workers' wages just barely keeping up with inflation. 1-800-892-6477. Do you see this in your own work situation, in your own life or not? And what constraints are there around raising pay? 1-800-892-6477. Again, email is exchange at nhpr.org. So, Matt, let's talk about productivity. I'm glad Dave brought it up because you've written about this too. You've said that one reason wage stagnation may be occurring is because productivity isn't what it used to be. Can you explain that a little bit more for us, please?
Sure. Yeah, Dave raised an excellent and important point. So think about productivity growth. Sometimes people talk about the economy as a pie, you know, like an apple pie or something for dessert. And they'll talk about the pie getting bigger. And that's the GDP growth that Elise talked about, growth in gross domestic product, all the different goods and services we make in the United States. And if you look over time, you can grow the economic pie for a country like the United States either by having more people work, and that's been part of it over the many years in the U.S. But the biggest reason the economic pie gets bigger is what's called, as Dave said, productivity growth, each worker making more goods and services. Now, what drives productivity growth tends to be some combination of new ideas, so innovation of smart entrepreneurs coming up with new companies and new products in IT or other industries, or it's just smarter ways of making existing goods and services. Part of that sometimes is investing in new capital, so new computers or new hardware that allow production workers in a manufacturing facility to do better. So productivity growth creates the potential for more worker earnings growth. And as Elise pointed out, when you talk about incomes for most families, you're really talking about their wages on their job. And part of the problem for the United States, especially in recent years after the financial crisis, is how slow productivity is growing. So the main measure that our U.S. government puts together, what's called productivity growth in the non-farm business sector, in the past 3 years grew by less than 1% each of those 3 years. So that slow productivity growth almost by definition means there isn't much potential because the pie isn't growing very much for workers' incomes to be growing along with it.
Can you explain that a little bit more, Matt? I think I know what you're getting at, but it's complicated because we often hear American workers are among the most productive in the world. Slow productivity growth, you know, gives the image of, you know, American workers, you know, taking long lunch breaks and staring at their Facebook pages instead of working. So, you know, when I hear slow productivity growth, I think, wait a minute. I mean, everybody I know is working really hard. Nobody I know is really slacking off. So can you explain that a little bit more?
No, great point. So you raised two excellent points there, Laura. One is to distinguish levels versus growth. The level of productivity of American workers in terms of the output per person on average is still very high compared to almost every other country in the world. And then the second important point you raise is, well, why does productivity grow? Part of it is the skills of workers. And so that speaks to when you think about trying to raise productivity for workers, things like our education system and public schools in New Hampshire and elsewhere, our colleges and universities. It touches on our immigration policy because part of how we bring talent and ideas into the United States historically is by talented immigrants. But then importantly, it depends on what kind of jobs companies in New Hampshire and in the country overall create. So productivity is kind of the combination of the skills of workers, but also the business environment for companies that determines what kinds of jobs they're going to make, the quality of those jobs. And Dave touched upon that earlier. That depends on policies like how's our tax code in terms of inducing innovation and research and development and new jobs? How connected are we to the rest of the world through policies like international trade and investment? Because one of the things we know is that globally connected companies, whether they're based in New Hampshire or elsewhere, they tend to pay a lot higher wages and be much more productive than companies elsewhere in the economy.
All right. Lots more to talk about after a short break. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join our conversation. We're talking about wage stagnation today in The Exchange. We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the long trend of wage stagnation in America, causes, and a little bit later, potential solutions to this national issue. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us with your perspective on this. 1-800-892-6477. Send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Matt Slaughter, Elise Gould, Dave Juve, lots of people want to jump in our conversation. But Elise, before we do, you know, Matt mentioned productivity. We talked about that. He also mentioned globalization. How do you see that playing into this wage stagnation discussion, the fact that we do have a more globalized economy today?
There are absolutely many different features of the economy in the U.S., internationally, that we need to be looking at. And he did point to productivity, and absolutely, stronger productivity growth has the potential to raise living standards through wage increases. The other thing he did not mention was sort of tight labor markets overall. And so we have seen different periods of productivity growth. Let's say the late 90s, we had great productivity growth that persisted through 2004, 2005. In the late 90s, we also had a tighter labor market. The tighter labor market plus the faster productivity translated into decent wage growth across the wage distribution. But then if we look at the early 2000s, where we still had that fast productivity growth, but not the tight labor markets, there was no decent wage growth. So I want to enter that sort of overall picture of tight labor market as being also the engine behind decent wage growth. And so what we've seen in the last 7 years, let's say, since the Great Recession began, and particularly in the last couple of years, the recovery has entered a period of solid job growth. And if we continued that job growth in the next couple of years, we would eventually look like have an economy like we had in 2007. We would recover fully, but decent wage growth is yet to be seen. And I think that's because the labor market is not tight yet. The unemployment rate is still elevated, and there are millions of missing workers out there that have not reentered the labor force because of weak labor market conditions. And I think until we see that, then we're not going to see that decent wage growth. So productivity is one part of the story, but the tight labor market is the other.
What about immigration, globalization, Elise? Some people, not everybody, but some people blame that for lower wages. They say, you know, immigrants are willing to work for less. Companies bring in high-tech workers on H-1B visas. They're willing to work for less. Companies outsource jobs to, quote-unquote, Indian China. That's the line you always hear. I'm not saying this is true or not, but some people at least do blame globalization for lower wages here in this country.
I think immigration is an interesting question. I think if we were to regularize undocumented workers, let's bring them into the system so that their wages have to have the same standards that everyone else's wages do, and they apply, all the laws would apply to all these undocumented workers, it would lift their wages and the wages of those in the same fields of work. And I think that that is something we need to do to make sure that people are not being paid under the table, to make sure that people are in the system, and that would lift the wages for everyone in those jobs and for American workers that are working in those same industries and occupations.
Go ahead, Dave.
Yeah, I think Elise makes a good point relating to unemployment, and also let me just touch on immigration quickly. A lot of when we're thinking about immigrant workers taking jobs away from Americans, the jobs we're really looking at are low-wage jobs to begin with. And
dishwashers.
Lettuce harvesters, that type of thing. But she touched on one other thing, too, employers who are using H-1B visas to bring in technical workers into the country. That's happening because we're not producing enough of our own. So, you know, when we talk later on in the show about things that the country can do in terms of public policy to try and break out of this cycle of wage stagnation, that's something that we should look at.
The education system. Yeah, some people have said that's why Canada is not seeing this wage stagnation because of their education system. We'll get to that for sure. But let's bring our listeners into our conversation to the exchange number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. What are your thoughts on this issue of wage stagnation? Do you see it in your own life, in your own family? And if you're an employer, how do you feel about this issue? Again, 1-800-892-6477. First up is Jason in Concord. Hi, Jason. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to make two policy points here. Prior to 1980, we had relatively consistent growth across all incomes. And something dramatically changed in 1980, and it's two things. One is a really direct attack on organized labor, and what you've seen is a dramatic decline in union membership. And with that, the effect of that, we've had growth in the economy. The effect of that is that today CEO pays make 343 times what the average American makes, compared to 42 times what they made in 1980. So the money is there. It's where it's being spent, and that's the effect of a lack of collective bargaining. But the other thing is minimum wage is a wage floor that puts upward pressure on the whole wage system. And the argument we're faced with is that it kills jobs, and there just isn't data to back that up. And the CBO report that's often cited, if you read it, it actually says that it's just an estimation based upon methods that aren't even agreed upon by economists. Most economists do not agree that raising the minimum wage hurts jobs, and I think that those two factors would really affect this problem or really contribute to solving this problem, and we just can't get it done because of politics.
Well, Jason, two big points. Thank you so much for raising them. To you first, I think Elise Gould, the decline of organized labor, he's saying that's partly why we've seen wage stagnation. We don't have unions advocating for stronger wages anymore.
That is absolutely true. Thank you, Jason, for your comments. The decline in organized labor is directly related to the increase in concentrated wages and incomes at the top of the distribution. Organized labor has helped historically has helped not only lift the wages of union members, but lift the wages of people in similar occupations and industries as unions in areas where unions are strong. So the decline in organized labor and the attack on organized labor that we're seeing today, this isn't just a long-term trend, we're seeing it today. We're seeing it across states that are trying to dismantle organized labor, make it harder for unions to form by passing right-to-work legislation that makes it harder for unions to have any sort of financial base. And that direct attack on unions is going to hurt many workers' wages. So that is absolutely right, Jason. And on the second point, it's true, the CEO-to-worker pay, what you're seeing there, is that concentration of wages and incomes at the very top because employers are increasingly holding more and more of the cards. And that's what we're seeing today as well. We are seeing that the wages of regular people are not increases. And there is an exception. And again, he points to the minimum wage. What we saw in the last year, if you look at minimum wage increases, and there are minimum wage increases in 2014, there were some in 2015 as well, but in 2014, minimum wage increases in 18 states that cover about 47% of the workforce. What that meant when you look at the wage distribution is that wages at the 10th percentile, those very low-wage workers, is the only glimmer of hope that we saw in the economy last year in terms of wage growth. Their wages actually rose, and you can directly link that to statewide minimum wage increases.
How many states increased their minimum wages last year, Elise?
18 states.
That's a lot of states.
Yes, some of them are legislated and some of them were index changes, and that covered about 47% of the workforce because they happened in some of the larger states.
You know, Matt Slott, I'm real interested in this union question that Jason raises. Others have made this point, too, that, you know, the same time you see wages starting to stagnate in this country is the same time you see union participation in the overall workforce going way down. I think it's at, you know, what, 7% now of workers are unionized or something, definitely below 10%. What do you think, Matt?
So it's definitely true that the decline in unionization rates in the U.S. economy is pretty striking. It's been happening for decades, and you're right, the private sector unionization rate, if you look at workers who don't work in the government sector, is now about 6.5%. So that's a force that's been happening as technological change has been going on, as globalization has connected jobs and companies more to the rest of the world. It's one of those forces that I think is contributing a bit to the rise in income inequality. I'll cite back to something you mentioned at the outset, Laura, which is the Economic Report of the President, which is this annual report that the Council of Economic Advisers produces each year that kind of comments on the state of the U.S. economy. And one of the interesting analyses that the President's CEA conducted this year was looking at the role of the big themes we're talking about in this conversation, productivity growth and income inequality and their contributions to stagnant wages for typical families in America. And yes, things like the minimum wage and unionization are important, but I'll stress that this report pointed out that they did some counterfactual analysis, meaning kind of rerun history in the data and imagine what incomes for the typical family would be today if certain things hadn't happened over the past 40 years. So the two kind of thought experiments that they conducted in this report were, what if inequality hadn't increased from 1973 through to today? So things like the minimum wage not eroding in real terms. And the other that I looked at was, what if productivity growth hadn't slowed like it has since 1973? And what's striking in the analysis was they estimated that today incomes for the typical family in America would be about 18% higher if income inequality hadn't risen as it had. But when they did the other thought experiment of how much higher would typical family incomes be today if productivity growth had stayed as fast as it had been in the earlier part of the 20th century, they found incomes would be 58% higher for the typical family. And so I think that just underscores there's a lot of forces at play when we worry about why incomes aren't growing. But again, I'll come back to the central role that productivity growth historically plays. That creates the potential, that growing economic pie, for more incomes to be rising.
So you don't buy, Matt, that the decline of unions is a big part of what has allowed wages to be so saggy?
It has played a role, but if if I think about the policymaking process and the limited time that Congress devotes to economic policy issues, I'd want more time and attention to be paid to the quality of jobs and these things like innovation and connectivity to the world in a way that supports the growth in productivity and therefore supports the growth of good jobs in America.
Okay, and I definitely want to bring some more listeners into our conversation. But Dave Duvay, I have to ask you before we go to another caller, what about Jason's point on the minimum wage that he and other people, when you do the reading, think that this is a way to raise the overall wage in America and improve this wage stagnation issue that we see that nobody thinks is good?
Yeah, well, the minimum wage, I think we can all agree, is an artificial rate. It doesn't bear any relationship to the value of the work being done, and it certainly can be raised. Those that don't think it would have an impact on jobs, I believe that it does, and I suppose if it didn't, we could raise the minimum wage to $100 an hour, and we'd all be better off. But we know that that's not true, and it's especially not true in our global economy, where, as you pointed out, employers are already looking at other lower wage areas of the world where they can get work done if the cost of labor becomes too high here. In addition, the minimum wage, I mean, it does create a ripple effect. It doesn't add to employer costs just for the lowest wage workers. It adds to employer costs for people all along the wage spectrum.
Because if I make minimum wage and you bump me up, then the next person above me wants to be bumped up.
Is going to be expected to be bumped up. And the other thing is, in New Hampshire, and I'm speaking just of New Hampshire, it's almost an irrelevant argument here because I don't know if there's anyone that is offering minimum wage jobs now. We're in a high labor cost part of the country. And I assure you, the person that served me my coffee on my way in today was making well above the minimum wage. So I'm not sure that it would have an effect in New Hampshire, but it will have an effect on employers. And we also have to recognize there are other costs to employers relating to employment that are also rising faster than inflation. And the cost of health care benefits, cost of health care in general, is rising far faster than inflation. And there are all sorts of other taxes and fees associated with compensation, like Social Security and unemployment insurance, where those costs also go up. So I do believe it does have an effect on employers.
Well, and we're going to have to do a whole program probably on this whole minimum wage debate, so I'm not going to dig into it too deeply now. But I do wonder, Dave, Elise mentioned 18 states did raise their minimum wages last year. What are you going to be looking at in those states, those sort of laboratories for New Hampshire to keep an eye on? What happens there and so forth? Do prices rise? Does the economy improve as those more highly paid workers, go out to eat or go bowling or whatever? I mean, what are you going to be looking at in terms of what happens in those other states?
You just answered your own question better than I ever could. Yeah, I think people will be looking at the impact. If in Seattle, if they raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, what impact does that have?
All right, let's take another call. And Brian's in Concord. Hi, Brian. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, I just wanted to comment to the fact that it's just a shame when a company is boasting high profits and they're not bringing their wages up. I suppose the argument could be made that they don't want to get locked into paying high wages that they raise in a good year and then have bad years following. But some of these companies could give bonuses or do more with profit sharing so that it's kind of in sync with how their business is going.
So even if they're – yeah, go ahead.
They just need to be good stewards of their business,
Brian, thank you for calling in. Matt, what do you think? We do hear that, companies are, quote unquote, sitting on cash. We hear about multi-gazillion dollar bonuses for those at the top. I mean, what do you think about Brian's comment?
So it's an important one. I think two things come to mind. One is there are some what I would deem to be really visionary and forward-thinking CEOs and leaders of businesses throughout America. An example I'll give is Howard Schultz, the CEO of Starbucks, who actually was on the cover of Time magazine a couple weeks ago, in large part because he's been thinking very deeply about how he can run a global company and meet the obligations of investors and the kind of financial perspective of business, and yet have it be a business that values every single worker, from the newest barista to the longest term person in the C-level suite. And so I think Howard Schultz is a terrific example of a company where he has been able to provide, chosen to provide, and found the financial means to provide health insurance to even part-time workers. And more recently, they've instituted a really innovative partnership with Arizona State University to offer to employees in the company an ability to finish their college degree. Their junior and senior year will be paid for by Starbucks by online courses for people who have a leg into working on a college degree but haven't quite completed it. So I think there's examples of companies like that. Then the public policy question is, what might we do with our tax code or other things to try to create more companies like that? The reality, the second comment I'll make on Brian's insight harkens back to something Dave said. Part of the reality is companies based in America today, their competition in 2015 is more and more these global firms from so many other countries around the world. We're in a very different environment for how businesses think about whom they're going to hire and how much they can pay. The sort of edge of the global economy is something that induces companies to be more productive, but with that sometimes becomes the edge of competition of trying to sell goods and services at a price that their customers around the world will pay. And I think that's something that has to be kept in mind here.
Let's take another call, another one from Concord. Nora, you're on the air. Go ahead. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. I am a wait person here in New Hampshire, and we make $3.27 an hour plus tips. And our tips are directly representative of what the rest of the community makes. One gentleman commented that, you know, the person that served you your coffee this morning probably made well above minimum wage, when in fact wait staff make severely low below what the rest of the world makes.
$3.27 an hour.
Yes, ma'am. Plus
yeah. Okay. Well, good luck with the tips, Nora, by the way. Yeah, go ahead, Dave Giffey. Thanks for calling, Nora.
Yeah, I guess I should jump in and say my coffee server was not a tipped employee. So, but she's right. In New Hampshire, at least, tipped employees do receive a lower wage than the $7.25 federal minimum, but they do receive tips, which should put their salary in excess of the minimum wage. And I would say, Nora mentioned that it's dependent on the economy or the strength of customers coming in. But in large regard, it's also dependent on inflation. As menu prices go up, those of us who pay based on a percentage of our bill will be tipping more.
Yeah. Okay. Well, and I can hear you want to jump in, Elise. I'm going to let you chime in after a short break. You can join us, too. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Back in a minute. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, it's our monthly check-in with political junkie Ken Rudin. Today in The Exchange, we're talking about stagnant wage growth in the New Hampshire and national economies, some of the causes, what this means. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Elise Gould with the Economic Policy Institute, I know you wanted to jump in on this whole issue of, you know, minimum wage and then Nora who called and who makes $3.27 an hour plus tips.
Right. So she said that she makes $3.27 an hour plus tips. One of the issues in our country is that it's true, as Dave said, is that she will make some from tips. If she doesn't make up the wage from tips, then employers are required to meet up to that federal minimum wage or to the minimum wage in their state. Unfortunately, for many restaurant workers, that is not made up for by their employers when businesses slow, and what's called wage theft can happen, such that the workers don't actually make the minimum wage in the hours that they're working. And it's hard for many minimum wage workers or restaurant workers to go to their employer and say, hey, I didn't make up the difference, give it to me, when those same employers are the ones that are building their schedule, making sure they get the right amount of hours. And so it creates a disconnect. And I think the Department of Labor is doing quite a heroic job of trying to prosecute employers who are not doing that. The other thing I wanted to say is that Dave pointed out that a minimum wage is is artificial and it's not linked to productivity. It's hard to imagine Nora's not worth at least $3.27 an hour to her employer, if not much more. That is true as well at the very top. Jason, who called in a little while ago, talked about CEO to worker pay ratio and how CEO pay is determined, and that is certainly determined in an artificial way as well by a boardroom of the CEO's sort of colleagues to determine what the pay is. And maybe that's linked to productivity. Maybe that's not really linked to how productive those workers are. And as Matt brought it back to Matt here, he said that it's a choice, right? Starbucks is making a choice to take the higher road. We see Walmart coming in and trying to pay more. And that is because they see they'll get reduced turnover and maybe higher productivity from workers if they pay more. And I think it's a choice. And we have made policy choices over the last 35 years to make it an economy where the wealth is concentrated at the top. And we can make a different choice. And that's all I'd like to say there.
Well, and here's an email from Tom who gets back to the productivity issue that you mentioned earlier, Matt, and that you just mentioned, Elise. Tom in Wolfboro says, the statistic on declining productivity must have just to do with the loss of manufacturing jobs. He says, in the real world since 07, when employers shed millions of jobs, the employees who remained were asked to do the work that used to be done by two or three people. Because companies were able to get by on that basis, they did not hire employees back for years, nor did they give wage increases because employees could not quit for higher pay. Tom says, I am in the dying newspaper business. We have half as many people here as we had 8 years ago. No one has received a raise in that time. You should discuss the wealth shift that resulted from this. There is greater profitability, but it is not being shared. That's the point you just made, Elise. But what about the productivity point, Matt Slaughter? I do hear from, you know, family and friends who work in a wide array of businesses, from small nonprofits to small employers to, I've got cousins who work for some of the biggest companies in, you know, corporate America. Everybody seems to feel like people are let go. And they're asked to pick up the work of the person that was just let go, in addition to doing their own work. So workers don't feel less productive. They feel like they're working harder than ever.
So great point, Laura. And Tom's insights about what he sees in his manufacturing facility and newspapers are important. Part of the challenge with the slowdown in productivity growth is to keep in mind how broad and large the U.S. economy is. So manufacturing today employs about 12 million workers in the United States. That's a lot to you and me, but in a labor force that's approaching 150 million workers, depending on how you measure it, that's actually only a small chunk of the labor force. It's only about 10.5% of all payroll jobs. And in retail trade, for example, another broad industry in America, we talked about Walmart and some other retailers in this conversation, there's now about 15 million people that work in retail trade. So the performance of the U.S. economy overall and the average wages that we've been talking about in this show depend on the complex interaction between what's happening in manufacturing, what's happening in retail trade, what's happening in a lot of other industries. And so what Tom sees is very real and relevant. The impact of manufacturing on overall productivity and wages in America is actually declining over time, in part just because it's a smaller share of the labor force. So when we think about policies to try to support expanding the economic pie, if I come back to that metaphor, we really need to think about all kinds of industries. It's services industries, it's industries like retail trade, it's engineering and consulting services, it's a whole bunch of industries. And yes, Laura, you're right that a lot of people whom we know, our friends and family in New Hampshire and elsewhere, they do work hard and they are working harder. That comes back to a point I made earlier about what determines the productivity of jobs in America is not just the hard work and effort of the workers themselves, but it's the kind of jobs that the companies that are hiring them feel they can and want to create in America. And so when we think about public policies, you know, our educational system, especially our high-skilled immigration system, helps determine the talents of people like Tom writing in here. But equally important are the public policies that shape what kind of jobs companies want to create here. And that comes back to things like our tax code, our trade and investment policies with other countries.
Well, and that's right up your alley, Dave Juve. Public policies to boost especially manufacturing. It's so frustrating to hear sometimes, and we hear this all the time, that manufacturers here in New Hampshire have quote-unquote good jobs, open, available, waiting. I'm looking at a copy of Business NH magazine. There's a big cover article, desperately seeking help. Manufacturers can't find enough workers to grow. We hear time and time again that these are good jobs with good pay. What's going on there?
Well, I think in manufacturing, there's a good news, bad news story. The good news is a lot of manufacturers who opted to open up manufacturing operations overseas are finding out that it may not have been everything that they thought it was going to be due to socio-political, geographic reasons, and they're bringing manufacturing back to this country. And
that's good news.
There's hundreds of examples about that. On the bad news front, though, manufacturing of today is far different than manufacturing in 1980 or certainly 1880. It is extraordinarily technical, advanced manufacturing requiring the highest degree of computer knowledge. And those types of employees are becoming harder and harder to find. And earlier in the show, we were discussing the tight labor market. That is the sector of the labor market that is the tightest. Now, there's a lot of things that the country could do or states can do to help assist that. In New Hampshire, my association is a big advocate of R&D tax credits because we believe it makes sense as a state to reward the types of employment that are associated with research and development. Another thing states can do is focus on STEM education and make sure that our schools, our high schools and colleges and universities are focused on the types of jobs that are high-paying jobs in the 21st century.
What about the governor's recent budget and now the legislative process has begun? Does it do enough for education, especially the community colleges and the university system here in New Hampshire? Those are big training pipelines for New Hampshire employers.
Well, the problem at the state level and the federal level is there's always competing priorities and things that the state has to do. We can't funnel more money to the university system and close down the prison. You know, so there are all kinds of competing priorities and a limited amount of state revenue available. Because I'm essentially a positive thinking person, I am trusting that the governor and our legislators will focus on the priorities that make sense and focus the spending in those areas.
Again, our number 1-800-892-6477. Tom, thanks for the email. The email address is exchange@nhpr.org, 1-800-892-6477. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. You know, as we talk about policy measures, Elise Gould, you've talked a lot about the minimum wage, about more profit sharing, perhaps, among those at the top and those at the middle and the bottom. What other policies do you think, though, Elise, broadly, could help bump up this wage stagnation issue that we're talking about?
So there are different ways of thinking about trying to make sure that people at the middle and the bottom are seeing decent wage growth. One of them is updating overtime provisions, and that's something that the president has made an effort to do, and the Department of Labor looks like they're going to come out with some regulations to try to update those because they've been stagnant for the threshold below which workers must get overtime has been pretty much still for many, many years, and we need to update that so that a much higher share of the workforce, just like there used to be, many more workers would get overtime. And now there are many workers that are either working off the clock, which is more of a wage theft issue, or they're working and not getting paid their overtime pay for it. They're being treated as salaried workers when they're really low and moderate income workers that should be getting overtime. So that's another policy that I think we should pay attention to and something that we can actually do something about in the current congressional environment. Also, one of the other things that was mentioned was the kind of investments in education, and that is absolutely important for individuals, and we need to have better economic opportunities. It's not actually going to fix the economic situation that we're in. If we look at occupations in the future, we actually are already creating enough college graduates to fill the need in the future. But if you look at manufacturing, for instance, we have more than 2 unemployed workers for every manufacturing job opening out there. And so there are a lot of workers out there in the labor force looking for work, out of the labor force, haven't come back in yet, and we need to create better jobs that those workers can fill.
The problem with manufacturing and the issue that Elise refers to is that the unemployed manufacturing worker skills are not well matched to what current manufacturing, advanced manufacturing companies are looking for. But there are ways of dealing with that, too. Here in New Hampshire, we have a worker training program that, unemployed individuals can access and manufacturing companies can access to make sure that their employees that they do have remain current with latest trends.
That gets
That's
back
great.
To the training.
And I think it's very important. It used to be the case, though, that employers themselves would train workers, right? They would go and they would make those investments in workers to make sure that they had the skills that they needed. Today, employers expect that either technical schools or community colleges or government funding will pay for the kind of training that their workers need, and they don't think that they need to take that on. I think we need to change the nature of the employer-employee relationship, again, so that workers can get that training on the job and do what they need to do for the employer.
Yeah, we've done whole programs on that idea of the skills gap, and whose responsibility is it to close that gap? I have a completely different question for you, Matt Slaughter, putting your economist hat on again. Is there a plus side to slow wage growth? For example, if wages aren't spiraling up and up and up, overall inflation isn't spiraling up and up and up. Is there a good news aspect to this wage stagnation, or is it all just bad?
Great question, Laura. I would say it's pretty much bad.
Okay.
But it's important to distinguish, I think, between what economists call nominal and real wages. So when we get our paychecks or look at our W-2s at the end of the year, as many people are doing with tax season upon us, what you see is a dollar amount that's written down. And so that's what economists call the nominal wages you get paid. In an environment where the general level of price inflation of all goods and services is going up, the prices of those wages tend to go up along with that. And so as you said in your question, we clearly don't want to be in a country, and you look around the world, you see some countries like Venezuela and others that are struggling with very high inflation right now. Prices of almost everything going up, including of labor. So wages are going up a lot there. But what really matters for economic well-being for families is not the W-2 dollar amount, it's how much they're able to buy in goods and services for themselves and their families. And so when we think about wages in what economists call real terms, taking account for changes in the cost of living, boy, it's really hard to see any reason why you would say, I really want to have a country where there's not a lot of growth in wages. And I'll come back to one of the themes I mentioned at the outset, which is you look at the anxiety that is present in a lot of families and among a lot of workers today. It's very palpable and pervasive in the data. You look at public opinion surveys, one that NBC and Wall Street Journal have done for a long time. And the question that they asked for decades is, do you feel confident or not confident that life for a children's generation will be better than it has been for us? And if you go back and look, the response is that even when we've had business cycle downturns in the U.S., it was still the case that more Americans felt confident about their children's future than not. But when this question was last asked a few months ago, only 21% of Americans said they were confident about their children's generation being better off financially. 76% said they weren't confident. So I think that's an environment that all of us, whether you're Republican, Independent, Democrat, would like to change somehow by having there be faster productivity growth.
You know, that's interesting. And Elise, I did read a couple pieces that relate to what Matt said, that there's a psychological reason that wages aren't going up to keep pace with inflation or just barely with inflation. And that's anxiety, Elise, among workers that they don't want to push. They've seen the Great Recession. They know that there are millions of people who have sort of dropped out of the workforce but might jump back in. So there's this anxiety to push for more, a psychological reason for stagnating wages. What do you think, Elise?
Sure. One of the measures we look at, and we've talked at many different economic measures, the labor market, is the quit rate. And I think that speaks directly to the quit rate, which has recovered in part, but not fully recovered yet. And the quit rate is an indication of whether or not people feel confident that they're going to be able to find another job. And they're simply not. Another point I'd like to make is that if you look at wages, and there's been some talk about sort of skills being rewarded more or needed more, and if you look in the last year between 2013 and 2014, real wages for workers with a college degree or even with advanced degree, those workers saw the biggest declines over the last year. So I think it's really interesting to think about where the demand is for workers and why the wages are simply not keeping up. So even these groups of highly educated workers who have faced historically and even today the lowest rates of unemployment are seeing outright wage declines. So I think there's a whole story here that it's that is affecting the spectrum of workers.
Well, and it's a big issue. It's happening in Europe, and we've talked about it nationally. Dave Juve, bring it back to New Hampshire for us. What specifically would you like to see happen? I mean, you can't solve the whole kahuna in one bite, obviously, but what are one or two things that you think would help make a difference here in the state?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think there are things that are easily achievable. We've talked about the R&D tax credit. That could be approved in New Hampshire. We have one, but it's at a relatively low level. We've talked a little bit about education, and the state could make a decision to focus on higher education standards. I'll give you an example. From the recent past, we raised the high school dropout age from 16 to 18, and that had a dramatic increase, or that had a dramatic effect on decreasing high school dropout rates here in New Hampshire. And one last area we could look at is housing. For those people that are in lower income areas, if we had policies that led to more rental housing availability, that would force prices down. And housing, if we had more affordable housing for our working people, that would also force prices down and make life a little easier.
Making the cost of living go down overall. All right, all of you, thank you very much. Dave Juve, good to see you. Thank you for being
thank
here.
Thank you.
Dave Juve, Senior Vice President at the Business and Industry Association of New Hampshire. Elise Gould, good to have you. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Elise Gould, Senior Economist at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington. And Matt Slaughter, thank you also for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
Matt Slaughter, Professor of Management and incoming Dean of the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Jason Moon. Our intern is Dylan Morrill. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.